From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Adam Warbach became president of the Sierra Club at the age of 23. He went on to become a green business consultant, and now his clients include Walmart, the country's largest retailer and a longtime object for environmentalists of their scorn and protest. How much work by companies like Walmart to improve their environmental record and work towards sustainability is greenwashing and shallow PR, and how much is really making or can make a difference? You might be surprised at what you find out next with Adam Warbach after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Make sustainability irresistible. That's the new maxim. Walmart, with 1.4 million employees and 127 million customers a week, prides itself on pushing. Despite its record as the nation's largest corporation, viewed for many years by environmentalists of all stripes as an environmental despoiler and breeder of toxins, not to mention an enterprise criticized for its poverty wages and sweatshop working conditions. Well, Adam Warbach is spearheading an effort now underway to turn Walmart green. Can it be done? Are we talking about cosmetic greenwashing and blustery PR or real quantifiable changes? We thought we'd talk about all this in this hour and talk about more with Adam Warbach, who at 23 became the youngest Sierra Club president in that organization's history. A longtime environmentalist, Warbach's pedigree goes back to efforts on his part as a second grader to get rid of then Interior Secretary and environmentalist bete noire James Watt. A member of the International Board of Greenpeace, Adam Warbach founded Act Now in 1998, a sustainability agency which worked on making businesses green, and they merged eventually with Saatchi & Saatchi to become the world's largest sustainability company. In 2004, Adam Warbach delivered a controversial Commonwealth Club speech entitled "Is Environmentalism Dead?", in which he inveighed against the failures of the environmental movement in not joining social and economic justice to ecological activism. So is the answer working within what was once seen by some as the enemy camp, the world of corporate giants like Walmart? Well, Adam Warbach joins us for this hour of Forum to talk about this and other matters. And good to see you again. Welcome.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Michael.
Well, let me go back to that 2004 speech I referenced as environmentalism. Well, first of all, what are you calling yourself now, if not an environmentalist? A sustainability-ist, or what is there a word?
I just try to be a person, I guess. That sort of works. I think the titles sort of get in the way.
Well, some are maligning your personage. The Center for Media and Democracy says he's a lot more green in his bank account, and then there's talk about you joining the dark side and selling out and losing your soul, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, as I was looking at this record, Kool-Aid guzzler, I think maybe would be the way someone phrased it. Record, I got to admit, is pretty impressive in terms of what Walmart's done and what Walmart has turned around here, despite the things you said about it in your book, Act Now, Apologize Later. You know, you really condemned them back then. And now they're doing a lot. I mean, they're turning green. It's not just greenwashing, is it?
Yeah, I mean, they're just starting. I mean, being the largest corporation on the planet, frankly, the largest corporation ever in existence, they have an enormous responsibility. And I would tell you, they're just getting started. And frankly, when I came on, I was deeply, deeply dubious. And these great people like Jib Ellison and Paul Hawken had been working with them, talking about setting goals. And they set these three big goals: produce zero waste, sell only green products in the stores, and be powered 100% by renewable energy, which were kind of incredible and unbelievable, frankly.
Had to suspend disbelief, absolutely.
Well, and that was when I first heard them, I thought, well, this must be greenwashing. And then they actually said, well, we want to do it. How do we do it? And that one challenging question seemed too hard to refuse, too hard to say, well, I just don't believe you. It hurts my identity to work with you, and I would be called a sellout, so I can't. So I said, well, let's see if we can try to do it.
And they have, when I say there's real quantifiable things to measure here, they've decreased, for example, the fuel used by their fleets. They're looking toward moving toward completely organic products and all of these kinds of things, having much diminished carbon imprint, footprint, whatever you want to call it. And so all of this looks good. On the other hand, there's a lot of training going on that brings up my skeptical antennae. You know, how are you going to get people to pledge to be sustainable and go through, like I take the vow or something, like abstinence or something?
Well, that's been actually the area that I've focused most on. It's basically called the Personal Sustainability Project. And the idea is, how do we entice the people who work at Walmart, the 1.3 million people in the U.S., roughly 2 million people worldwide, to care about sustainability and to make it something that's personally important to them. Because our belief is that this group of people, which is something like one out of every 100 people who work in America, I mean, a huge and large group of folks, if we can figure out a way to make it exciting to them, something that they want, then we'll be able to create, to convince the rest of America to care about it as well.
And it's a voluntary process.
Well, though. Absolutely. And the question is, well, let me just share with you, we basically share lots of information around sustainability and we sort of say, well, is there something useful here for you? Is there something that you would want to personally commit to, some personal sustainability practice that you would commit to that would bring this into your life, be good for your family, and be good for the planet? And what we found is that over and over, they're saying yes. I mean, roughly out of those 1.3 million people, about 500,000 associates actually have a PSP, a personal sustainability practice. And after about a year, they're keeping with them. And there are things, Michael, that you wouldn't expect, or I wouldn't expect, frankly. There are things like losing weight. There are things like parking in the farthest spot from the in the parking lot and walking all the way there. There are things like trying to eat organic once a week, not because of the organic, that's a good thing, but just because it's a good chance to have a family meal and learn to cook something new. They're taking it in a slightly different way than kind of the deep green environmentalism that I grew up with.
Well, you've said that they have done more, that is Walmart now, for sustainability than any organization, environmental organization that you've worked for, and you stand behind that.
Well, I think if you look at the direct outcome in recent years, I think that's the case. I don't want to minimize what the work of the environmental community has done and really setting the baseline framework for the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act here in the U.S., and globally understanding kind of the consultations on biodiversity. These are important things and much greater than any one corporation could do. But if I look at the last 20 years and look at my record as a full-time activist working on CO2 reduction, I mean, the United States went up 16% in our CO2 use since basically we negotiated Kyoto. And what have I done working on legislation, working on all this activism when nothing that went forward?
I'm telling you, there's a zeitgeist. When Bill McKibben was on and when James Gustav Spaeth was on, and now I'm reading this new book by Sachs, the international economist, who will be on Wednesday, there seems to be a lot of disillusionment with the environmental movement. But then I read a statement by someone like Carl Pope, who has your old job, president of the Sierra Club. That's not your job, was the head of the national. But he's on the board now, and he's been with the Sierra Club for years, and he says you're kind of missing the forest from the trees here. You're not greening the supply chain. The supply chain is what matters because we get leaded toys from China. So this is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, according to Carl. This is frivolous.
Yeah, Carl's the executive director of the Sierra Club, and you know, he's an important activist. I think, though, that he misses the point because, of course, Walmart's working on the supply chain. I mean, what Walmart is a supply chain orchestrator. It's someone who figures out how to get the lowest price for its customers by getting supply chain efficiency. And sustainability is a way to make the supply chain much more efficient. And sometimes things will happen that are pretty great. Like, for example, this week, Walmart committed to taking out BGH from all of its private label milk. I mean, that's something I've been railing against, Monsanto's bovine growth hormone in milk, what it does to kids, and all sorts of reasons. And Walmart could just basically make a decree because it saw that its consumers were more and more not wanting that in the milk. And that will be the tipping point that will take BGH out of milk everywhere, not just at Walmart.
So this is a consumer movement. It's like a grassroots consumer movement of sustainability. That's where the focus
is. It's just starting. I mean, and if you look back in the history of social revolutions, I mean, consumption has been at the center of it. I mean, from bread shortages in France, you know, Marie Antoinette says, let them eat cake. And they say, no, that's not. We need bread. You look at the Woolworths lunch counters sit in, you know, people saying it's just we're not going to spend our money if we are not treated with respect and dignity. There have been consumer movements to make social change for a long time. And it makes a lot of sense that that one happens here. The problem is that if we're honest, it's really not a consumer movement yet. In San Francisco, yes. In the rest of the country, absolutely not. People are not willing to pay a little bit more or to take a little bit less efficacy of their product that they're on the shelf buying because they don't. That's not that high of a value to them.
No, we forget that San Francisco is in this cocoon. We're talking to Adam Rohrabach, who is global CEO now of Saatchi & Saatchi, a sustainable agency that consults some of the world's leading corporations, not only Walmart, but Frito-Lay, Kaiser, General Mills, on how to enhance sustainability, and he also serves on the 6-member International Board of Greenpeace. And I'm thinking about the Sierra Club again because you had another brief with them back in the day, I mean, on immigration and population, did you not?
Yeah, I was remembering that. I think that might have been the last time I was on the show, and the calls from the callers were sometimes not pleasant. I think, you know, to my mind, it's another symptom of a smaller view of what sustainability should be. I mean, if we basically have We are going to have 9.5 billion people on the planet. That is just inevitable. The demographers say that's going to be the number by 2100. So we need to figure out, how do we have enough energy to get every person out of energy poverty? How do we have enough food to get every person enough food? How do we have enough education? How do we have enough rights for women so that we have a global system that can help provide these things? That's our challenge. CO2 is one of our challenges, but these other things can't be forgotten. I mean, Michael, things have changed so much since we started. For example, right now there's roughly twice the number of people on the planet who are overweight than are starving. It's a totally different world than when we sort of thought that the biggest problem was starvation. The biggest problem right now is that people have too much to eat and they don't know what to do. How do we solve that problem, and how do we use that as a way to push sustainability instead of kind of looking at a diagnosis from the 1970s?
But you know, what's come up repeatedly is the fact that you could start a massive consumer movement, get unanimity among Americans, and really cut back and do extraordinary things. And yet we've got the global problem, and the global problem seems almost unsolvable. I mean, what do you do about China? What do you do about India? They all want SUVs. They all want, you know, what we have, and they feel entitled.
Well, I think they want to be happy, and they want to, you know, first of all, get sort of through the Maslowian pyramid and make sure they have food, shelter, water, safety, basic things. And then they're going to consume for fulfillment. They're trying to fulfill themselves through things that they buy. And you know, we know the end of the story. You can't actually be happy through the things you buy. And the research really shows that, you know, happiness basically doesn't raise after you make about $10,000 a year.
Yeah, but it's not only happiness and material want. I mean, China's building huge... building big coal plants all the time. I mean, they're still building them all the time.
Well, and China has pulled roughly 300 million people out of abject poverty in the last 10, 15 years, which is one of the greatest justices that's happened on the planet in my lifetime. So we can't, I mean, they have spent atmospheric resources, but they've pulled people out of starvation. And that's something we need to celebrate and not just say, you know, oh, you know, we have to stop buying things from China. I mean, the things we've bought have helped do that. Now we have to ask the question, how do we invest in China? How do we invest in their energy security? How do we make clean energy not more expensive? How do we not raise prices, the price of energy, but how do we make it much, much cheaper so that people in China can have the energy they need so they can develop and have the same rights that we have?
Talking with Adam Werbach, who is global CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi S, by the way, and I get that S in there. A lot of this has to do with scale. I mean, that's a big issue and critical. I mean, if you're talking about global corporations, you're talking about really where the power is. You want to go on to Toyota and Procter & Gamble. I mean, it's sort of like Napoleon, right? One big corporation after the other, and make them responsive to consumers and make them aware of this kind of sustainability notion.
Yeah, I think scale is, and that for me has been the biggest understanding that, you know, after spending all this time working with Walmart and understanding that Walmart, as the biggest corporation on the planet, is not big enough because they mostly hit people in the U.S. And frankly, they can't set the rules of the game. They're just one company. We need lots of companies to work together. And frankly, what we need is a much more robust political system and much better political leaders, not just in the U.S., but globally. But those two things together.
You're backing Obama?
I am. Yeah, passionately.
This saves money, though. I mean, it's always been the green argument, but like Walmart is finding it's saving money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it saves money both in the supply chain. And they basically, for example, they've sent out their energy engineers to their suppliers and said, hey, we're going to help make your manufacturing plant more efficient. So they go in, they give them advice. They're inventing all these new technologies. They're creating patents on the way that they do heating exchange systems, all those sorts of interesting things. They go in, they help the supplier reduce their cost, and then they ask for a discount. Walmart says, we want that cost back. And we're going to pass it on to the consumer, to who walks in. And we're also going to pass it on to our shareholders. And God bless them. I think that if they can find a way to save energy and save money, I think the consumer should benefit.
Whoever thought they'd hear Adam Werbach saying, God bless Walmart. But here you've heard it on the forum. at this point, tell us about the difference between green and blue.
Well, you know, what I've sort of seen in my travels, particularly in kind of the mature, you might call them the mature green markets of Western Europe, is people moving beyond an understanding of green, because green is actually mostly focused on nature preservation, atmospheric preservation, protecting the earth itself. And there is actually a broader movement of people who just want to make a difference on all things that they care about. They care about healthcare. They care about education. They care about spending time with their family. They care about making a difference when they actually go to the store. And green is just one piece of it. And what's emerging is this concept of a blue movement, something that's broader than green and something that encompasses all the sort of green understandings, but actually has a broader set of concerns.
So those concerns are broader in what context? What are we talking about?
Well, I mean, the first thing it asks is, you know, what we sort of consider the three P's. You know, the way people market things normally is the four P's of marketing, you know, price, product, place, and promotion. And the three P's of of a blue movement are much more like price, purpose, and process. What's the price of this thing that I want to buy? Is it, you know, I actually believe in trying to buy things that are less expensive because that actually makes them possible for being mainstream. Is it priced fair? Or is it something I can spend more for, but it becomes more durable and lasts longer, and therefore it's good for the earth and good for my pocketbook? What's the purpose of what I'm buying? Does it have a long-term purpose in my life, or is it just going to be another junk I have to put on the shelf and something else I have to maintain and something else I have to throw away eventually? Does it fit into the practices I have in my life? For example, if I'm on a diet, right, is this something that's going to support my diet, or is this just an organic Oreo cookie? Well, it's great that it's organic, but it's not really helping my diet or my trying to be healthy and prevent disease. And then finally, what's the process? How was it created? Was it created through slave labor somewhere? Was it created in a way that was too energy intensive? Was it created in a way that I would be proud of? Those
three
things.
You're getting to social justice issues, yeah. And then you've got a five steps to what you call a new culture of consumerism. And give us that.
Well, the big one is understanding first that consumer action leverages structural action. It's the belief that consumers can change the planet, that you can go in and you can actually vote with your dollars and pocketbooks, that, political action actually happens generally on a biannual basis, and consumer action, happens every day.
You believe in consumer action, really,
don't
you?
Yeah. I mean, the average American woman spends an hour a day shopping. And she wants to reduce that time, frankly, because she spends a lot of time searching rather than finding. But she also wants to do something with that hour a day, and might as well give her that chance. So consumer action leverages structural action. I don't believe people should sacrifice price for their values. They have to demand that things are cost competitive. Because if I pay more because I can afford to, then I'm also telling that person who's living paycheck to paycheck that they cannot choose what I choose. And they desperately want to. And the sort of idea that we're going to lead people into the promised land is, I think it's kind of smug. And I think the green movement tends to be a little bit high and mighty on that sort of
thing. The green movement is also, people are willing in wealthier neighborhoods to pay more because they have more to pay in many instances, right?
Well, it's sort of like the person who has the green 8,000 square foot house,
yeah,
or the person who tears out their kitchen to create a green kitchen. It's like they're just using it to justify what they want to go and do. Well, just go do what you want to do, but please don't make the atmosphere pay for it.
So what else are you talking about in terms of
I think that long-term behavior,
new culture?
The third thing I think is that long-term behavior is more important than short-term impact. People always focus on what exactly was the thing that, what was the carbon impact of that particular thing. And ultimately, we want to build healthy lifestyles for people. We're killing ourselves with the way that we eat, the way we don't exercise. We're killing ourselves in lots of different ways. Climate change is only one of them. So I think if we focus just on climate change and not look at how this fits into a lifestyle, we kind of miss out.
See, these are kind of what you call nano practices.
Nano practices is a very simple way of looking at how people build behaviors. I've been an organizer my whole life, and we always try to convince people to become Democrats from Republicans, and or something of that sort, or change candidate views. And my experience is that it's very hard to get someone to make a big decision, but it's very easy to make someone a small decision. And what the great thing about consumer action is that it's something very, very small they can do that might have a tiny effect on their pocketbook, and they can feel good about it. It can be a beginning step. And our question is, what's the smallest possible action we can ask someone to take, and how do you add those together through personal sustainability practices so you can actually create a lifestyle, a behavior, an image and identity for yourself that actually does make a difference?
Then what do you do when you go to Walmart employees and you say, we want you to make a difference as employees, make a difference in your own life, park farther so you can walk more, excuse me, those sorts of things, and a lot of them hate the company they work for.
Well, I'll leave it for people to walk into Walmart and ask, my experience is actually that Walmart workers are surprisingly engaged in the company. And that's actually been something that we sort of looked at. Do people like where they're working? And it has one of the highest engagement scores in the retail sector.
It's ironic because, its reputation is for treating its employees miserably and giving poverty wages or just above the level of poverty.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say,
not exactly
Walmart is
favorable toward unions either, of course.
Well, Walmart, it's so large that everything bad about it is probably true. And everything good about it is probably, it's just a very large system. I mean, Michael Marks called it the White House of the marketplace. It is so big. I mean, roughly 200 million Americans shop there regularly. And, what I always sort of ask is,
only 127 a week, 127 million a week.
Yeah, it's something of that. I mean, the numbers the number also I heard was 89% of Americans shop there at least once a year. And that's something they might be on a vacation or where they're shopping there. So if you haven't shopped there this year, you're weird. I mean, that's a strange concept. And I hadn't walked into a Walmart before I started working with them. I if someone saw me, I would sort of have to wear a disguise or, you know.
But you saw a lot of employee loyalty. You saw a lot of that.
I saw it. And, you know, frankly, if you ask people to complain about their job, they will. I mean, of course. And I'm not sure if you would. But my experience is that lots of people have problems with their jobs.
You're not sure if I would?
How is your job,
Michael? depends what day you ask me. Naturally, we're talking with Adam Werbach, who is a global CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi S. And you finding the same kind of response with these other companies, Frito-Lay, Kaiser, General Mills, as you are with Walmart?
Well, yeah, I mean,
or are they different cultural, different corporate cultures?
Everyone's different. I mean, and you know, the truth is that Walmart is a complex company and has lots of problems and lots of good things about it. In sustainability, I can really speak to their commitment and what they've done. I'm enormously impressed by it. The big thing they've done is they've asked their suppliers, and these are lots of Fortune 500 companies, to come along and lead as well, because most of Walmart's carbon footprint, most of its impact is actually in the supply chain. So, I mean, a company like Frito-Lay, you know, Sun Chips is a great product. It's healthier than typical potato chips. And they have a plant in Modesto that's actually going to become completely solar powered, which I love, right? A potato chip factory, a sun chip factory that's made by the sun. It seems so obvious, right? But that's the type of thing that we're sort of seeing happen. And, of course, it pays for itself, right? It just makes sense. A lot of sun in Modesto.
Initial investment, though. I mean, solar power is still more expensive.
And making a commitment internally that we had to accept a lower return on investment over time. But it would also have a benefit, right? It would make the people who work here appreciate it, and frankly, the consumers, the people we eat. And this is a brand that's growing, you know, 30% a year, a huge $300 million brand, a large, large company that's making these sorts of commitments.
So speaking of commitments, I mean, you have the employees come in and they raise their right hand, I do pledge to be a sustainable.
No, I mean, and the truth is that I've never asked someone to commit to anything. I mean, the answer is except the senior management. But the associates ask themselves. So in Walmart stores, I encourage people to walk in and talk to folks. And it's not everywhere because it's voluntary, but there's roughly 10 sustainability captains in every store. And they're, you know, their job is to help talk to people and see if they want to get engaged and get involved with this. And the crazy thing, Michael, is that it's happening all over the place. So I just heard we had our first detention because of this, and this wasn't at Walmart. The daughter of one of the captains in Battleground, Washington, set up a PSP for herself to recycle. She went into school and she drank a bottle of Coke or something. And her teacher said, well, now throw that away. And she said, actually, I'm going to recycle. My PSP is recycled. So she put it in her backpack. And the teacher said, no, throw it away. I asked you to do it. Don't, you're being, you're not listening to me. She didn't throw it away. She refused, and she was given detention. And she's since been on that time on a campaign to get recycling programs in all the schools in Battleground, Washington. And actually, just last week, in the two middle schools and one high school in Battleground, they started recycling programs because a little girl is just a little, small disobedience.
Well, since I said at the beginning that I was impressed by some of the statistics, I just want to back that up by saying that right now, Walmart's the largest producer of organic cotton. As Adam said, they have organic milk. The fuel efficiency of their truck fleet has been reduced by 25% in 3 years, and they've got sustainably harvested fish, and so it goes. But the real question here is, can a company like Walmart be made green? And what about sustainability? Join us. In fact, we invite you to do that. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We open our phone lines. Your opportunity to talk to Adam Werbach, our guest, who is global CEO of Saatchi & Saatchi S. Again, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send an email, forum@kqed.org. And Adam will be at the Commonwealth Club this Thursday, April 10th at 6 p.m. When we return, your calls and emails on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. We're talking to Adam Werbach, who once was the youngest president in the history of the Sierra Club, is based here in San Francisco, has served as a sustainability consultant to Walmart, and recently sold his firm to global advertising giant Saatchi & Saatchi. We're talking about his goal to, quoting him, construct a consumer movement for sustainability and risks of corporate greenwashing. Let me go to your phone calls, and we'll go first to New Bedford. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering, I have a question and a recommendation for Adam. One, the question is, why did Walmart choose to limit their truck idling by going to the auxiliary gen sets, which still use diesel, which still, you know, little engines that run overnight for their truck fleet, instead of going to shore power, which is what campers use when they pull into a campground and they hook up to the electric grid, and obviating the need for any diesel use at all by the truck fleet. And my recommendation is that Walmart could set up a half dozen spots at every store so that not only their own trucks could use shore power, but other trucks. A lot of trucks park overnight at Walmart stores, and they could pull in and use shore power as well and not run their engines overnight, save a lot of fuel.
Good recommendation. What do you think?
I'll share that back. I mean, one of the things that's been most exciting is that there's been lots of great ideas, and they're open to anything, frankly, anything that'll save money. And the reason why they have this backup power on trucks is because it saves fuel if you have it on a battery, basically, when the truck driver's sleeping, for example, instead of on diesel. It saves fuel, and that saves them money. They own their own truck fleet. They pay for the gas. So if they spend less fuel, it's good for the atmosphere, but in the end, it's good for their bottom line.
It's also good for their PR. I mean, let's not absent this from the conversation. When Walmart does these kinds of things and says we're more green and we're doing these things, you know, there may be people high up in the hierarchy who are committed. In fact, I'm assuming that there are, and from what I've read, there appear to be. But nevertheless, it's good PR.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is yes. I mean, Walmart, though, has, to my mind, sort of gone bent over backwards to sort of not proclaim that they are green. In fact, the CEO, Lee Scott, was just quoted saying, we're not green, and people jumped on him. And the answer is, well, of course they're not. You know, Yvonne Chouinard once said that Patagonia wasn't green. There's no such thing as a green company. We're all striving. And for Walmart, because it is so large and has such a big footprint and impact, it has a much higher bar to pass. So it's one reason I think they've actually been very, basically very humble in what they've communicated. And frankly, this April is the first time they're actually pushing ads out to consumers by saying, go in and buy pure water filters, go in and buy bamboo socks, go in and buy concentrated detergent. It's the first time they're actually testing out to the consumers talking about green.
On we go to more of your calls. Grant, you're on. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Thank you for the show, and I thank your guest for his work. I'd like to preface my comments by saying I understand that we need really strong relationships between the for-profit sector and the nonprofit sector, and I appreciate what Saatchi's doing. However, at an organization called the Equality Project, we fight for sex orientation and gender identity non-discrimination policies at major companies, and Walmart is the most egregious offender of making the disconnect between environmentalism and human rights. In fact, there's a second shareholder resolution on the table right now, which the company is opposing, to adopt a non-discrimination policy and domestic partner benefits and basically the equality principles, which hundreds of companies have adopted. They simply refuse to do it, and every gay and lesbian consumer knows that Walmart is one of the most egregious offenders in this regard. So I think we need to shine a little light into the corner about the reality of how this company treats its employees and hires other companies to make the public believe otherwise. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call. Adam Warbach.
Well, that's not my understanding, at least in terms of working with gay and lesbian associates at Walmart. They tend to be quite proud of their company. So I don't actually have, I haven't worked on Walmart's policy on these things, but I have worked with associates who are from the community. And
They're discriminating against gays and lesbians. They can be sued. It's that simple.
Yeah. So I encourage people to sort of research it themselves and see what they find.
We'll find another caller from Palo Alto. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I really like the program, and I have bought organic cotton sheets for my baby from Walmart, so it is doing good work. But I have a question about Walmart's role in changing the way the consumer goods products are advertised. For instance, when I see an all-natural product that has high-fructose corn syrup as its main ingredient, I have a problem with that kind of advertising. And I'm wondering if the speaker could address, I guess, how, yeah.
No, he's nodding his head. Adam, yeah, go ahead.
I agree 100%. And that's one of the reasons why we took our company Act Now and joined Saatchi & Saatchi, which is a global advertising firm, because we actually believe that that the advertising is not just failing consumers, it's failing the companies because it's not giving people what they want. I mean, one for me is when 7-Up launched itself as all natural. Now, there's nothing all natural about 7-Up, and there's these ads with hummingbirds sipping out of 7-Up, and there's like these plants growing 7-Up cans, and it's a joke. And the truth is, we've just sort of bent these words out of so they're unrecognizable. And the truth is, we need a lot more honesty in our communications, and that's something that I completely
agree. What do you do
agree
about that?
Well, the first thing is you point at them and you talk to those companies. I mean, I for example, saw a Poland Spring ad where there was they took a little plastic out of their bottle. It was a bottled water company, and they had this ad of this tree kind of hugging this guy who was drinking the new Poland Spring bottle, a little svelte eco bottle, they called it. And it sort of said, you know, if nature could say thank you, it would say thank you. And the truth is nature's not saying thank you to anyone for drinking a bottle of water.
Especially if you're putting it in a plastic bottle.
Yeah, it's like, it's, you know, it's the worst it's the best of bad options. And we'd much rather see people drinking out of water, out of reusable water bottles and using water filters if they need to.
There's a problem that comes to mind here. I mean, with plastic water bottles, obviously, you're going to have to do something radical with the rising environmental consciousness, not only about water as a resource, but certainly about the plastic form that water comes in. But that kind of movement is really having, I mean, this is also just another side of the consumer movement. I mean, Michael Pollan was on recently, and just what he's talking about in terms of adding to global warming by transporting such large distances unnecessarily and impeding that or reducing that is really part of obviously what we're talking about here in sustainability.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Pollan's rules for eating, you know, eat food, mainly plants, not too much. That's great. We need actually those sorts of cultural rules in food, but we also need them in shopping more broadly. I mean, for example, I think the reason why people are going to get off bottled water is not the ecological reasons, but because of the outrageous cost. If you go and install a pure water filter right now and stop drinking bottled water, if you feel like you need it, in Bay Area, we have really wonderful water. You don't need it as much. But you can save $600 a year. I mean, a consumer who buys that much bottled water and just displaces it with a water filter and using a reusable bottle can save $600 a year. And that's the reason why they're going to change. Because right now, Michael, as I go across the country, people are struggling. You watch people paycheck to paycheck. I mean, I know that when I go and work at a Walmart.
Especially people who work at Walmart.
Well, I mean, the people who work at Walmart are much like the people who shop at Walmart. And I know not to go into a Walmart on the 1st, the 15th, the 30th, or the 31st, because that's when government assistance and paychecks arrive. And that's when people in America have money. They don't have money in the different days because they're living paycheck to paycheck.
And we go to more of your calls for Adam Warbach. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, I have a question. I'm graduating from business school in May, and what I went to business school for is to integrate my background of politics and business and kind of CSR my mentality, and I'm looking for a career in that industry, specifically within large corporations, because I feel that it's become necessary from a consumer perspective, but also from, like you were saying, from a business perspective, to understand all aspects of sustainability and equal treatment, et cetera.
Well, welcome. I mean, we need you. We need you. Not just Saatchi and Saatchi, but the world needs you right now. Right now, we are reinventing the economy. We've been invented in a moment of the Industrial Revolution, and now we are in part of the Sustainability Revolution, and we need you right now. It's exciting. I mean, this is the work of the next generation, is to reinvent everything. Take the energy out of it, take the waste out of it, take the
mood
out of it.
You're still as enthusiastic as you were when you went around with those petitions against James Watt, aren't you?
I'm so optimistic right now.
How do you sustain that? Talk about sustainability. How do you sustain your optimism?
The best thing for me is getting out with people. I mean, the Walmart associates have given me the biggest gift in the world, which is by just educating me about what I knew and what I didn't know. And what I thought I knew about sort of the preciousness of my environmental identity, that green was more important than everything, they put in context that they had other things going on in their lives. They have, you know, type 2 diabetes, which is a scourge across America, that they're really trying to lose some weight, that they're trying to find ways to spend time with their kids. And what they taught me was that what I knew was a way to help get what they needed to do get done. And that's the thing that's just made me, you know, feeling useful, actually.
Well, you can be useful with our listeners because they're sending a number of emails here that you can respond to. Here's David in Oakland who says, many Walmart stores are located in areas that don't have an effective local recycling program. Couldn't Walmart use its distribution network and its central place and its customers and employees' daily lives to create a national recycling program?
It's coming. I mean, it's not there yet, but the recycling that's happened at the store has been amazing. And the reason why is because it's saving the store managers lots of money. And, you know, everyone at Walmart who works at Walmart gets a share. Basically, it's a kind of a profit sharing process for every employee who works at a Walmart store. So everyone knows basically how much their costs are. And one of the top part of the cost has been tipping fees. So there's a way that basically they do these things called super bales, where they take all the cardboard, the corrugate, the aluminum, the things that they can collect off the packaging and put them in the baler, and they recycle it. And they get money back, and they don't have to pay the tipping fee. So everyone in the store is very highly motivated to recycle at Walmart now. And we're hoping that turns out to be consumer-facing.
Here's Rick in San Jose. Says, problem that Walmart faces is that it is the poster child for an unsustainable lifestyle. It is the largest retailer on the planet, and its business model is all about convincing people that they can have and need more stuff for less money. The model is backwards. Consumption needs to cost more, the true cost of an item from creation to disposal, in order to allow people to pay the full cost of their consuming. Producing in a green manner is good. Less consumption is best.
If you can do with less, do with less. I think that's absolutely right. And I think we need to teach people how to shop. And this is sort of thinking about the purpose of the item that they're buying and whether it fits in their lives and whether they actually need it. But I have to say, one thing I've learned is not to talk about making things cost more money, because people are really struggling right now. And if you can't afford to have your medication, and you know, Walmart sells $4 prescriptions. And I know a lot of people who I've interacted with who can't afford, who shop there, who can't afford to basically use that $4 medication over the entire month. They're kind of cutting it up. So they have less. And if you tell them that things should cost more, that energy should cost more, and they should pay more, they're going to feel like you're prioritizing their life. And we don't have the power to do that, or shouldn't be doing that.
Some more emails. We'll go to Diane, who says, does Walmart provide employee subsidies for hybrid car purchase? If so, how much of a subsidy?
It doesn't. It doesn't. I know that some companies are doing that, which I think it's a great idea.
Push it, Adam. Will you?
Well, one thing that Walmart did was that I really liked, a couple store managers, for they basically started giving transport vouchers instead of people driving their car. Because and frankly, it was a very, they did it around Christmas time because they realized that the parking spaces were being taken up by employees instead of potential customers. It's good business.
Carrie says, if a company like Walmart essentially responds to the bottom line, doesn't success in getting them to go green or even blue mean that setting the true environment or social costs of products and processes is of fundamental importance?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, what's been good to see, and I think Walmart needs to even go further on this.
That could mean they'll cost more, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you're going to make carbon cost more. I mean, we desperately, desperately need in the United States carbon regulation and a global carbon cap as well. And we need the U.S. to join in. If we do that, I mean, Walmart is going to outcompete its competitors because it's pulling energy out of its products. It's making lower power products. It's making less packaging in them. It's actually, it's saving people money. For example, they just came up with Hoover with an EcoVac that is basically a third less energy in it. It uses a third less energy. And that's going to save people money, and it's going to, in the end, benefit them as carbon becomes more expensive.
And here's Faye, who says, I represented our company in which did business with Walmart. They made us change our 31B containers of protein powder to 11B containers so that customers would have to drive back to the store more often. Is that green? I don't think so. Walmart gets results by squeezing its suppliers. There's nothing green about it.
Well, I don't like that idea that someone, and if a buyer did that, I think that would probably be unacceptable if someone actually said that's their goal. They're not trying to make their consumer, the people who shop there, unhappy. So, and in terms of them being hard on their suppliers, I think one thing that they have to look at is longer term relationships with suppliers. So if they're investing in changing their manufacturing facilities, they'll have a 10-year relationship with Walmart.
But that's, again, the supply chain that Carl Pope was calling attention to.
Well, and that's, you know, really understanding. I mean, Carl and I have argued because he believes that the supply chain should remain vertically integrated, that basically every company should own its manufacturing all the way through the line. But that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be clean manufacturing. It's still very, very hard to get this done, as opposed to actually having a little more flexibility so you can actually work on both price, but also have the idea of having new ideas flit into people who are subbing for you. I mean, the ideal supply chain is kind of 70% booked by one company, one sub-manufacturer working about 70%. So 30%, you're getting new ideas, and it's not becoming just so staid and doing it the same way. If you own the manufacturing plant and it's polluting, you have very little incentive to change it.
We go to San Anselmo. Warren, you're on forum. Good morning.
Hi, Adam. This is Warren with Common Current, a consulting firm. Walmart's supply chain, which is primarily from China in terms of non-food products, causes untold pollution during production in poorly regulated factories. That product is then transported with ships burning highly polluting bunker oil and transported to stores with trucks across the nation's highways burning a lot more oil. Customers must then drive their cars to 99% of Walmart's, often long distances, and its giant parking lots produce great quantities of water pollution. So how sustainable is all that?
Not very. I mean, I mean, I'm the last person to tell you that Walmart is a sustainable company. It's not there yet. It's got a long way to go, a huge amount to go. Of course, we all do, right? But it, as, by being the biggest, has a higher responsibility. And I mean, I think what we have to ask for them is that they move sprightly towards that direction.
Higher responsibility, but I think the caller is also raising an important point. Is it even possible to think of long-term sustainability for a company of Walmart, given the practices and given ongoing practices?
Not unless it changes radically. I mean, really, it changes the format. It changes what's on the shelf. And frankly, right now, the management, the leadership of the company is ahead of the consumer base. And that's why we actually need this movement. Consumers aren't walking into Walmart going, where do I find the organics? I'm not going to shop here anymore because it's not organics.
You got to lead them there.
Well, right? I think we all need to. I mean, this is the idea of a blue movement, of course, is something that's really shared, that we have people who are going to say, you know, instead of not going and boycotting Walmart, go there and put pressure on them to sell the products that you want. Because that's the only way we're going to have all the people who want those products won't shop there. So it's like it's not going to change unless the people who want them go in and buy them.
Ralph, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Your last commentator covered some of what I was going to say. This feels a lot like a giant advertisement for Walmart, honestly. But I guess since the last caller addressed that issue, I would bring up the point that if people really want to make a difference in terms of environmentalism and sustainability, that they not drive long distances and they consume less. You know, walk to your corner market and ride your bicycle and bicycle commute and take public transit. So.
And I would encourage, I mean, I absolutely. I mean, I'm not suggesting that you go consume more and go buy it in a higher package place. I am saying if you you can make a difference in little things that you do. If you can do it and you can find a way to live that way in your corner store. I mean, I live and shop at my Bernal Heights corner store. I love it. And that's where I live. And I love it. But that's not most people on the planet. And frankly, it's not most people in America. And if we actually get to care to actually speak to them, we have to be we have to meet them where they're at today. And today they're shopping at Walmart.
Well, you make that distinction about, you know, it's middle America and it's the people out there who are very different, maybe mainly than perhaps people here in our cocoon in the Bay Area. What are you finding? I mean, you're getting a lot of skepticism here, especially about Walmart, and you've heard a lot of this since you've taken this role. What are you hearing out there in the hinterland, and especially from the employees themselves?
Well, I mean, they are, you know, enormously proud of their company for doing this, and that in the end has been, you know, you ask about whether they're engaged. This has been a reason why they're engaged, for them to be engaged. Walmart has sort of indisputably become the leading corporation working on sustainability. There's no one of their size or their scale as serious as them, and the people who work there are pretty proud of it. Because it just like you should be, or I am, if the company that I work for takes a leadership stance. So that's something that they're doing. But I think the thing that's most heartwarming to me is just talking to lots and lots of people and seeing how sustainability is something they didn't really know about, that seemed like kind of a lefty or democratic or something. It seemed like a political identity could actually be something that would service their lives, that would save them money and help them live better.
So when you wrote back in your book, Act Now, Apologize Later, about Walmart destroying local communities and all those kinds of things, is that pretty much thrown out now, or is that do you refute all that?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm the last person to tell you that Walmart is a perfect company, that Walmart has no problems. I mean, Walmart has a ton of problems, and that's actually keeping me very, very busy.
Yeah, in fact, I think they create havoc in towns, I think, was maybe sort of what you were saying essentially back then when you wrote your book.
Yeah, I mean, I think things are changing, and the question is how, in this new world, how do we live in it?
So what does this mean in terms of your view of corporations? Certainly when you were in the Sierra Club, like many of members of the environmental movement, of the rank-and-file members, as well as the leadership of the environmental movement, you were very critical of corporations, although, frankly, I've got to go on the record as saying that many big environmental organizations like the Sierra Club operate like corporations in terms of lobbying and, you know, doing what corporations do. But nevertheless, there was certainly a spirit and an animus, I think would be the appropriate way to describe it, toward or against corporations.
Yeah, and I still feel it. I still feel very uncomfortable in corporate settings, and I am a mission-driven activist. I'm trying to figure out what can I do to sustain the planet I live in. That's why I wake up in the morning. That's why I go to, you know, it's what I worry about. I worry about how am I going to create a planet for my kids that they can live on and be happy about. And the truth is that I am pragmatic and opportunistic about that. I'm going to take whatever gets the most done for my mission. And right now, and certainly over the last 8 years, political action has not been a place where we've actually had much success. Yet I've bumped my head and taken banged against that wall for a long time. Whereas corporations now are saying, hey, this sounds great. How do we do it? How can we go? And I'm not going to refuse that call. I'm going to say, hey, let me tell you. And let me tell you honestly what you need to do. And let me be really frank about what you're not doing right now. And let's have a relationship.
So if they're listening and they're responsive and they're willing to take action, that's ultimately the pragmatic test. That's what matters.
And this is the greenwashing test, right? Are they willing to do more than they're going to say? And if they're doing less and they're saying more, then that's just greenwashing, and I'm not interested in even hearing about it.
But, you know, there are those who would say, oh, Warbuck's a turncoat because he's even working with these corporations, companies like Walmart, which I'm sure you've heard.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's sort of different views of capitalism. Some believe that capitalism is a flawed system we should stop. And
this is Paul Hawken capitalism we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Paul Hawken is just, you know, his leadership in this is it's hard to overstate the importance of it. I wouldn't be surprised if you see Paul Hawken receiving a Nobel Prize at some point. I think that history will look back at his work, and particularly the ecology of commerce, all the way through to his new book, Blessed Unrest, as really the most influential thought leadership on the planet on this subject.
I think you can nominate Paul for the Nobel. Anybody can nominate for a Nobel Prize, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
I'd be proud to.
Let me go to a caller from San Francisco. Art, you're on.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I listened to the program, and it's a great show as always. And I'm getting the feeling that Walmart will do anything they would do anything to cut their costs, but also they would do anything not to raise the pay of their workers, which would be fine. I mean, after all, they're there for profit. However, if I'm not mistaken, Walmart pays so little to their employees that they can't afford their own even health insurance provided by the Walmart itself. And they encourage their own employees to go on federal programs like Medi-Cal, Medicare, Medicaid on the East Coast, which eventually costs taxpayers dollars. So eventually the whole of society pays the price. So how sustainable is that? And can you comment on that, please? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. You're in this uncomfortable role here, Adam, of having to almost be an explainer, apologist for everything of Walmart, unfortunately. I empathize, but you want to respond to the call?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say I'm not a spokesperson for Walmart, and I can really not speak to what I've worked at. I encourage you to look at it yourself. I mean, some things I've been proud about that they've done is that they, for example, started working with SEIU on universal health care, which I think is exciting and important. And you know, they don't. I know they don't encourage people to go on Medi-Cal, for example. You know, you can basically get health care at Walmart for as low as about $8 a month. It's mostly catastrophic care. And the truth is, though, I don't think Walmart's going to fix health care. The best thing that they can do is drive costs out of it, which they're doing, like $4 prescriptions, et cetera. But really, it's something that the federal government has to take leadership on.
What's it been like working with Saatchi & Saatchi?
It's been exciting. We just actually won a contract today for RailTeam, which is a global, or it's actually a pan-European rail network. And basically all the railroads of Europe are getting together and saying, how do we compete with airlines? And of course, the best way to do it, of course, is to say, you know what? We're going to save carbon. You know, it's less than half the carbon to ride rail than air. So we're going to
help
make
consumers more aware of what they're benefiting.
Oh, and it's just great. I mean, riding the train, you get to talk to someone else. It's a much nicer experience all the way across.
We're talking to Adam Warbuck. By the way, he'll be at the Commonwealth Club April 10th. That's this Thursday at 6 p.m. You going to talk about blue-green again? What are you going to talk about?
We're going to be talking about the emergence of this new blue movement. I mean, when I gave the speech on the death of environmentalism, I sort of said, this is winter, and you know, we are losing right now, and something needs to change. And I sort of said, I'm going to go and try to find that, and I'll come back in the spring. And it took me more than 3 years to do it. But I feel like springtime is here. And this blue movement, this movement of people through the products and the people that touch their lives, that I think is going to be is the next thing.
But, you know, I mentioned a kind of zeitgeist, a lot of criticism of the environmental movement, looking for new ways, looking for grassroots ways to remedy these problems that we have that are so formidable. I wonder if a lot of this is just disillusionment, certainly seems to be on your part, with the ineffectual nature of the environmental movement to really solve problems.
Yeah, I definitely went through a lot of that. I mean, hey, there's some environmental groups that are doing great work now. I'll always be a fan of the Sierra Club because it's a grassroots group. It really supports people working in their local communities on trying to make their community better. That's its core power. I think particularly D.C.-based groups that have for the last 8 years been trying to pass policy within the Bush administration have been kind of kidding themselves. And we've been sending them our money and saying, well, go change the world through policy. And you know what? The world wasn't up for changing.
So you're changing the world.
Well, I think we're all trying. And I guess I just want to invite everybody to, you know, even if you're sneering when you walk in, walk in and go talk to the store manager, go talk to an associate. If you care about organics, talk to them about why it's important and share that. If you care about buying a CFL light bulb, I mean, yeah, join 125 million other people who did that this year at Walmart. I mean, there are changes happening, but join in that consumer economy. You can hate it. You can turn your nose to it. Or you can say, well, I can use that as a way of voting, as a way of making things better. And that's what Saatchi & Saatchi is trying. trying to do is say, let's reinvent the way that people buy things.
And what else are you telling people to do as far as sustainability in terms of their commitment to sustainability?
Well, the first thing is to see it as integrated, right? It's not just about environmental sustainability. It's social, it's cultural, it's environmental, it's economic. It's all those things tied together. And the first thing to do is start with yourself. Create your own PSP, your own personal sustainability practice, and see what that is. If that's losing weight, if that's biking to work one day a week, if that's shopping at your local store, whatever it is, do that. And then see how it can connect to the things that you buy. Are the things that you buy fitting into your PSPs?
But, you know, as Dan Zoll is pointing out to me, people are making a lot of tough choices. For example, is local better than organic? That kind of question.
Yeah, I mean, in my family, we tend to focus on local as opposed to organic, just because I tend to think that, you know, I want to support the local economy here more than, but you know, we make choices all the time in that way. So,
that's why you hang around those Bernal Heights coffee shops, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, and frankly, that's the great thing we have about living in the Bay Area is that we have lots of thought. We have lots of impassioned conversations, and we are an incubator. And I was mentioning to you, Michael, is that I'm watching all these big companies come to the Bay Area and say, what are your ideas? What are you doing? Because we're the closest thing to Europe and the United States, the closest thing to the leading edge. And we have it. We have a responsibility to come up with new ideas. But the other thing we have to do is, if we're a pioneers, we shouldn't tell everybody that they're wrong and evil and bad for not being like us. We should say, join us. We're a place that may be slightly ahead, but we have a great solution. Come join us. We're going to be a lot of fun to be with. This is an irresistible movement, and you should be welcome to join.
Well, it's been an impassioned conversation and certainly an enlightening one. Thank you so much for being with us, Adam.
Thank you, Michael.
Adam Warbach, again, will be at the Commonwealth Club this Thursday, April 10th at 6 p.m. And if people want to get in touch with you?
SaatchiS.com, SaatchiS.com.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday. We're going to be preempted tomorrow because of the congressional hearings with General Petraeus, and we'll be back with you on Wednesday with Jeffrey Sachs, international economist and expert on poverty. And an hour is repeated in the evening, as you know, 10 to 11. And as I hope you also know, we are appreciative of your listenership. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Tina Larberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. We have production assistance from Nick Vidinsky and also from Inga Schrobsdorf, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thank you for being a part of today's program. For all of us here at Forum and KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.